Good afternoon and welcome to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Today we are fortunate to have a world-class panel of experts on hand to discuss the current Middle East conflict. John Alterman will be here in a second. We are especially delighted to have with us Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski, one of the foremost minds in foreign policy. Dr. Brzezinski was, of course, President Carter's National Security Advisor, and he is a counselor and trustee here at CSIS. John Alterman is the Middle East Program Director at CSIS and a former State Department Policy Planning staff member. Daniel Benjamin, he is a senior fellow at CSIS and former National Security Council Director of Transnational Threats. Dan is also the author of The Next Attack and the Sacred Age of Terror. Dr. Brzezinski has to leave us today at 2:30, so he'll now say a few opening remarks, and then we can open up our entire panel to take your questions. It's my honor to present Dr. Brzezinski.
Thanks very much. I'm going to be brief. I'll just make a few general comments and then be responsive, if I can, to any issue that any of you wish to raise. Let me say that basically what concerns me is that it is not clear to me what exactly the United States is trying to accomplish by not taking a stance in favor of an early ceasefire. I fail to see what U.S. interests are served by that. I have no illusions that any call for an early ceasefire would in fact produce a ceasefire. It will take time to get one. So what is the United States gaining by delaying it, except in a sense clarifying to the region its position less of a protagonist and more of a mediator in the ongoing conflicts? I am not sure that this is in the American interest. Secondly, it's not clear to me what Israel thinks it will gain by delaying a ceasefire. I can well imagine the calculation that one can clear out the Hezbollah south of the Litani River or even beyond if one wishes. But what then? Unless the Hezbollah agrees to a ceasefire, some form of protracted conflict will continue in any case. The prisoners that Israel wishes to have released will not be released. There'll have to be some accommodation on that at some point. So the question is, will the removal of the Hezbollah from the south of Lebanon make the Hezbollah more inclined to have a ceasefire, more inclined to engage in negotiations? Or perhaps it would still prefer to engage in protracted conflict, waging asymmetrical warfare against Israel? I'm not quite sure that the calculus is all that clear-cut in favor of the former proposition. Moreover, a protracted conflict will involve more casualties for both sides, and the casualties for the Israelis are not light, given the population of Israel. One can calculate that if Israel has lost, let us say, up to 30 military personnel so far, that is the equivalent of 1,500 for the United States. That is not insubstantial. Beyond that, there is the problem of the political costs of the continued hostilities. World public opinion is turning against Israel because of the civilian casualties. Now, I can understand that civilian casualties are to some extent unavoidable in any kind of warfare. And they're particularly unavoidable in warfare, which is heavily waged also from the air. But it is difficult to justify some of the casualties, particularly in areas which are not close to the combat zone, and that creates political costs and moral dilemmas. By way of reference, let me simply remind you of the fact that NATO waged a 78-day long aerial campaign against Serbia, the purpose of which was to force Serbia out of Kosovo by imposing serious costs on Serbia, focusing, of course, on infrastructure, but in the process also producing what is sometimes euphemistically called collateral damage. NATO admitted up to 30 incidents involving civilian casualties that were unintended. Human Rights Watch conducted a very extensive investigation after the end of the hostilities and discovered that this was an underestimate, that in fact the number of civilian incidents were larger. Human Rights Watch visited 91 sites, cities, towns, and villages that were exposed to NATO bombing, and located at least 42 sites in which there were civilian casualties. And after 78 days of bombing, approximately 500 casualties were identified. That is roughly five times higher than the rate of civilian casualties inflicted so far in Lebanon and in Gaza by the ongoing campaign. For the hostilities in Lebanon and Gaza have now lasted 2 weeks, roughly. The Serbian hostilities lasted 11 weeks. This suggests that perhaps some of the casualties were the result of excessive use of force or not closely supervised use of force. And that has political costs. And after all, unless one is waging a war for a total victory to be achieved, because existential dilemmas are being confronted, political costs and moral costs are intertwined. And that is something that neither the United States nor Israel, both being democracies, can entirely disregard. My final point regarding the questionable value of a delay in seeking, not in obtaining, but in seeking a ceasefire, pertains to the role of the Arab community, the Arab region. What was striking in the early days after the beginning of the hostilities was the widespread criticism of the Hezbollah, including by Arab governments. And that foreshadowed at that moment perhaps the possibility of some collective stance that would be favorable to a resolution of the problem, not only in Lebanon, perhaps also in Gaza, that would be favorable to a more lasting resolution of the problem. I'm afraid that with the conflict continuing, the radicalization of the Arab masses is going to become more pervasive, the sympathy for the Hezbollah more extensive, and as a consequence, the prospects for a favorable outcome beyond some sort of ad hoc solution will be reduced. But perhaps I should stop at this.
We'll open it up to questions, and if you could identify yourself by tapping your microphone and giving your name and news organization, that would be terrific.
Omar Sheikh was chief of the Kurdish service of Voice of America. Dr. Brzezinski, everybody is saying that Hezbollah is fighting a proxy war for Iran and Syria. And the administration is saying, and even the Europeans are saying, that Syria and Iran should put pressure on Hezbollah in order to negotiate and resolving this conflict now. But at the same time, they are not willing to talk to Syria and Iran. Is that possible without even having a dialogue, even if it's indirect, with Syria and Lebanon to find a solution for this crisis?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that I agree that Hezbollah is fighting a proxy war for Syria and or for Iran. I think Hezbollah is fighting a war for itself, right or wrong, which the Syrians and the Iranians are indirectly assisting. But I do agree with the thrust of your point, of your argument, namely that if this issue is to be resolved, we have to talk in some fashion with the Syrians and the Israelis, because they are supporters of Hezbollah, and Hezbollah would not be able to sustain a prolonged... I'm sorry.
Syrians and Iranians.
What did I say? Israelis. Sorry. Well, that is a big difference. The Syrians and the Iranians. Hezbollah cannot sustain a prolonged asymmetrical warfare without some outside assistance. And that raises a further complicating question in all of this. Would Hezbollah had the freedom to strike the way it did if the Syrians were still in Lebanon? We viewed the expulsion of Syria as a great political success, just as we viewed the democratization of the Palestinian political process as a great success. Unfortunately, the consequences in one case were clearly undesirable. In the other case, at the very least, they're ambiguous.
Tyler.
To both Dr. Brzezinski and John, today the Israelis have suffered, I think, 18 dead in an area, 18 soldiers killed in an area that they thought that they had secured. Is it your sense that a shock like this will embolden the Israelis to hit harder, or do you think it would have a sobering effect? And a second question to Dr. Brzezinski. A couple of days ago, you said that you described the U.S. policy in the Middle East as the basic test of America's capacity to exercise its global leadership. A general question, how do you assess that capacity today, say, compared to 3 years ago in April of 2003 after Baghdad fell?
Well, I think the American capacity to influence events in Israel has been going down steadily over the last several years. We have not been able to define the outcome in Iraq. We have not been particularly successful in the promotion of democracy in the fashion that we pursued it, even though the goal is desirable. We have not made much progress in promoting the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. And it is not very evident that in recent times we even tried seriously to promote it. And it's very difficult to see much effect over the last 2 weeks for whatever steps we have been taking or for whatever we have been saying on the subject. On the issue of casualties, if the 18 dead figure is correct, imagine the impact on American public opinion if news out of Iraq tomorrow was that in the course of the day 900 American soldiers died. I think the impact will be severe. Now, it will be severe, but it will not be the same throughout the country. I think there will be a sense of shock, there will be a sense of anger, there will be a sense of outrage, there will be some desire for revenge, but there will be a lot of people saying, where is this taking us? And this is why I'm frankly baffled. I'm genuinely baffled why the Israeli government thinks that a ceasefire is not in its interest. Because I don't think they'll accomplish a genuinely strategic success by continuing the hostilities. They may achieve some tactical successes, but without either obtaining the original objectives or being able to stop the Hezbollah from continuing some undeclared warfare of its own choosing, considering the fact that it's based not only in the southern Lebanese region, but it's also north, in the Bekaa Valley, in Beirut itself, and about 35% of the population of Lebanon is Shia. And these people are enjoying more and more sympathy from the others who feel themselves victimized by what is happening.
On the issue of the impact of the deaths on Israeli public opinion, it plants the seed of doubt, but it plants that seed in pretty unfertile soil. Israeli public opinion is 90-95% in favor of the current military operations. There's a sense that this is really a just war, and the Israeli general public is at risk. So it creates the possibility of a change, but I don't think it pivots Israeli public opinion in any way. It doesn't mark the turning point. I think the issue of American global leadership is a vital one. I must say I was stunned at the outcome of the Rome conference. I don't understand the point of having the Rome conference unless you know it's going to be successful. It seems to me that what has happened is it casts in sharp relief how difficult it is for this administration to be a global leader, how difficult it is to set the terms of debate. And on an issue like this, where so much prestige was riding on it, to be unsuccessful in such a public way, to not even be able to salvage it with an expression of common urgency, it strikes me as a real setback for American diplomacy.
Hezbollah disarmed and get out of the area. Set fire and let nothing happen. and the inevitable very terrible impacts of Israel, the Israel response, and Trump and Iran criticize the Israeli response, doesn't it show the irrelevance and the hypocrisy of the UN within this region? And secondly, some people say this is what this is really the beginning of World War III. And if that's the case, in any sense, isn't it better to fight Hezbollah now than wait till Iran is
I'm willing to respond. Well, first of all, as far as UN Security Council resolutions are concerned, if the point of the question is that they should be respected, then they should be respected, all of them. What about Resolution 242, 338? Have they been respected? And who has refused to abide by them? It wasn't Hezbollah. So, unfortunately, there is a rather poor record of respect for UN Security Council resolutions in the Middle East because the parties concerned cannot accommodate and the parties outside are not prepared to push the peace process seriously. And that's the dilemma. World War III, no, I don't think so. Let's not exaggerate. We're dealing here with a difficult local militia and that has a fair amount of popular support in its own territory and is gaining increasing support in the region. But it's not a World War III. I don't think that it's going to command much support outside of the Shia community at this stage. And if some of the other Sunni Arabs decide to become more engaged, I think that kind of a conflict would be very one-sided in the short run. Now, in the long run, there is a serious problem emerging, namely, is it in the interest of the United States and of Israel, given its location, to engage in activities which do not dampen down the fanaticism, the radicalism, the extremism, but rather intensify it? And I think that's a dilemma that we all face.
Hi, Phil. Nice to see your face, not just hear your voice. Two elaborations, shall I say, on what Ms. Biggs said. The first thing is that I don't think any of this reflects on the UN. I mean, it reflects on us. It reflects on the international community, and it reflects on American leadership, the fact that no one ever did much after the Syrians withdrew in terms of fulfilling the terms of Resolution 1559. It was a very difficult problem to disarm the militias, and as we're seeing now in the discussions about who would actually be in a buffer in an international force that might actually have to do some peace enforcement, there are not a lot of people out there who want to confront Hezbollah. So that's a big problem. Nonetheless, the international community and the United States included dropped the ball on 1559. The second thing that I would argue, and I'm agreeing with Spig here, is that not only is this not World War III, I think if anything, it's a very confined and limited outbreak of hostilities. Both the Syrians and the Israelis have said they have no intention of engaging one another, and I think it's in their interest not to. Although if this goes on for a long time, then the chance of miscalculation increases, of course. And I don't think anyone wants to take on the Iranians right now. I think actually that this is a self-insulating problem. It's a very serious problem, but I don't see this breaking out. I think if you wanted to talk about a bigger problem, then perhaps we should talk about Iraq instead, where the level of orderliness seems to be decreasing by the day.
Very quickly, I think you have unanimity that this isn't World War III, partly because none of the states in the region want World War III. Right? I mean, the war is with non-governmental organizations, not with states. The states don't want a formal war. In your question about the Security Council resolutions, you talked about how Hezbollah provoked this war. I think Hezbollah was provocative, but it wasn't provoking a war. Hezbollah had done the exact same thing in the past, had never had this outcome before. That outcome was a war of choice waged by the government of Israel. It's a choice that Ariel Sharon consistently decided not to make. because he thought that a war against Hezbollah would be a strategic diversion from Israel's true national security needs. This is a war of choice that Prime Minister Olmert has decided to wage, I think in part because his party was elected on the premise that unilateral withdrawal brings peace. And his country is now fighting to reestablish its deterrence in the two places where unilateral withdrew from. And they lack a strategic paradigm to replace the platform on which they were elected. I think the importance of that is it makes it harder to end the war. Because if you don't have a governing strategy for what you're going to do, if you don't have an overall vision, it's harder to say that your goals have been met. And that, it seems to me, is what an American role needs to be, to step in and help supply that lacuna in Israeli strategic thinking right now.
Hi, Mark Silva, Chicago Tribune. You spoke earlier of the early widespread criticism for Hezbollah, and I'd like to take you up on your invitation to bring Iraq into this. And how troubling is it that in Iraq, which was supposed to be our beacon for democracy in the Middle East, the leader now cannot see fit to condemn Hezbollah for acts of violence that other people have criticized Hezbollah for? How troubling is that to the overall situation, and what does it say again about the U.S. Position in global diplomacy?
It's obviously troubling, but it's hardly surprising. It seems to me that if one is surprised by these reactions, one shows a complete misjudgment of what has been happening in the Middle East for the last several years. We're dealing with a very serious wave of radicalization produced in large measure by our unwillingness to address seriously the Israeli-Palestinian peace issue, and then by our decision to wage the war in Iraq under circumstances which somewhat departed from standards of both legitimacy and credibility, if I might put it obliquely. Well, I frankly don't understand what that phrase "birth pangs" means. And, you know, it kind of suggests distasteful rejoinders, which I will not undertake. But I suppose implicit in it is the notion of some sort of a grand upheaval in the Middle East, out of which then democracy will emerge. I think it's a rather risky proposition, given what's involved in the Middle East, given what the global economy depends on from the Middle East, and given the fate of the peoples involved in this sort of slightly abstract formulation, which seems to imply some radical transformation of the sort that occurred, for example, in Europe after World War II. These are hardly very promising implications.
Thank you. Onur Sazak with Turkish newspaper Referans. Dr. Brzezinski, in the last week, the Turkish Prime Minister called the White House to express a similar interest in pursuing a cross-border operation in northern Iraq to deal with the KKK insurgents. If this war in the Middle East prolongs, how is this going to impact countries like Turkey in regard to their interest in dealing with their own terrorism issues? Thank you.
You know, one look at the map of the region suffices to realize that there are a great many potential additional ethnic and religious conflicts that have not yet been ignited. And this is another reason one should be extremely careful in how one responds to an ongoing crisis, and why one should be very determined to dampen it out, to extinguish it before it spreads. So while the Prime Minister of Turkey may have been raising an issue of immediate concern to him, the fact is that there are great many other issues of that sort just waiting to be ignited, and I don't think it's in the interest of anyone to see any of this spread.
Of the Kipling, Kipling News Service.
Which?
Dr. Brzezinski, the notion that NATO should get engaged is being pushed in Germany by rather unusual sources. I'm talking of Cohen Bendit, the former revolutionary of 1968, now a respectable politician, and by the Green Party. Germany's Green Party, the leading German pacifist. What do you think of the notion, of the idea?
Well, just to make it a little more absurd, let me say that I also favor it. And I have favored this for a number of years, and I was once attacked very strongly by Krauthammer, the columnist for the Washington Post, who thought it was a crazy idea. Well, I'm now reassured that not only I favor it, in addition to Convendi and the Greens, but apparently the Israeli government is prepared to consider it seriously. I think it's a step in the right direction. I wish it had been taken earlier. But better late than never. If we can implant in some fashion after a ceasefire, because we can't do it without a ceasefire, a NATO force in southern Lebanon, and no one will come in if there's no ceasefire. No one's going to go in just to fight the Hezbollah. If we can find some formula for a ceasefire which permits that to take place sooner or later, and I don't think later is going to be easier than sooner, then we'll have set an important precedent for ensuring in the long run the security of Israel in its relations with its neighbors, and I think we'll have advanced the possibility of having a serious settlement that has the character of some reciprocal legitimacy. But it can always have a settlement imposed by force, but if it remains illegitimate, it's going to be contested. So if you want to have a stable settlement, it has to be legitimate to some extent for both sides. And if there is a NATO force in southern Lebanon, then the question will arise before long. Why not in Gaza, for example? And then why not in the West Bank? And I personally would say, why not? I think in the long run, something along these lines offers a real possibility of creating the kind of reassurance that may make a genuinely fair settlement feasible for both of the parties or all of the parties. I have to leave it to the next one. Sure, I entirely agree with the proposition that there is little criticism of Israel in the United States, except perhaps outside of the House of Representatives. But there is a very special explanation for that. And it's 2 years in office, continuous fundraising and campaigning, and that makes you extremely sensitive to anything that undermines your political prospects. But look at the American press, you know. Abstracting from the editorials, let's say, in the Washington Post coverage certainly conveys a great deal of sensitivity to human suffering. The New York Times also, I suspect many other papers and magazines do. And I understand, I haven't seen them yet, but I understand that there are public opinion polls now, which are going to come out very shortly, showing a great deal of concern within the American public about the suffering, the level of violence, the desirability of a ceasefire. So I'm not sure there is such a fundamental difference. Now, on the level of politics, that's different. On the level of decision-making, I think the administration has had a rather militant and absolutist notion of how to achieve peace in the Middle East. laced with strong overtones of black and white morality, and has been holding steadfast to these notions, whereas the Europeans are more pragmatic, more sensitive to the complex history of the Middle East. But what is striking to me, and I think John put it extremely well about Rome, is that neither side is exercising much effective leadership. It is essentially stalemated. We, in part because we don't want to move, the Europeans in part because they want a move, but by us. And that's the problem. So I think that's a dilemma we're locked into. Europe may have different views than we, but essentially it is not prepared to act on them on its own because it can't. And we're not going to abdicate at this stage, at least, our decision-making to the Europeans, because we are very wedded to the notions that have put us on this downward slide in the Middle Eastern region as a whole. I'm sorry I have to leave, but I have two colleagues here who are much better informed than I, know much more about it, and will be even freer with their judgments after I have left than when I'm here. Excuse me very much. Thank you.
Oops. Continuing on. Questions?
Oh, did you want to present? Do you guys want to present?
Some more questions? Down here.
Natalie Ahn from the Asahi Shimbun. Could you talk more about a potential international force like a NATO force? What specifically would it need to do? Would it need to disarm Hezbollah, or would it support the Lebanese government in doing that? And what are the biggest obstacle or the biggest challenges that it would face in order to be successful?
I happen to think an international peacekeeping force is not a good idea. I've seen peacekeeping forces work. I've never seen peacemaking forces work, and it seems to me that this is essentially a peacemaking force. Even if you have a ceasefire, Hezbollah has not demilitarized. I can't imagine how you'd begin to write rules of engagement for when people would be allowed to fire. Our problems doing that, I think, were magnified after the fall of Baghdad. Do you fire on people who are looting? I mean, that's just a tiny sliver of what would need to be arrived at. It seems inevitable to me that an international force would be perceived as foreign invaders, colonizers, if you will, especially from formerly colonial countries. I mean, I understand the attraction of it because it's something we haven't tried yet. I would be much happier about the experimentation if we had experimented successfully with this idea before, and my fear is that we haven't. And this is something like a Hail Mary pass in the final minutes. I don't think we need to make it, and I don't think we should.
I think I'm not quite as skeptical as John is, and I think that there is a dimension of this entire crisis that is reminiscent of other calls for help from other regions, well, the same region of the world, I'd say, in 1973 when the Egyptians crossed the canal. And in some ways, not directly analogous, but something similar to what happened in the Kargil crisis, in that you found one party saying, we need international intervention in a way we haven't had before. And so I think there is a certain amount of exhaustion with the situation on the ground and a desire to try something else. So there is a need for some experimentation. It could be that the example of the Balkans, and Yugoslavia in particular, over the last decade might provide some instruction. But I agree with John completely. This is uncharted territory and extremely... extremely hard to see the way forward. I think that we're in one of those situations in which it's very hard to see the way forward and no one can see any other way.
And there's no going back.
And there, well, that's a very important point because pick up on what Dr. Brzezinski was saying, you know, from the Israeli perspective in particular, a ceasefire is going back to the status quo ante and is therefore unacceptable. So we are in a very deep jam right now.
So I want to ask John.
There. Good looking guy.
So, about an international sport, what
You know, part of this problem, and Dan put it well, the Israelis are unwilling to return to the status quo ante. The U.S. is unwilling to return to the status quo ante. But that doesn't mean that, therefore, the world has to come up with some more acceptable solution because two parties are unhappy with it. I mean, at some point, you also have to redefine your war objectives. And it seems to me that where a lot of this work needs to go is for the Israelis to figure out where are they really trying to go. Because I really think that they're spinning. Ariel Sharon had, it seems to me, decided very firmly that the most important thing was getting the heck out of the West Bank. And he wasn't going to be diverted. Because he said Israel's long-term interests cannot be served by maintaining an occupation. And he used the word occupation. Israel now has no prospects of leaving the West Bank in the foreseeable future because of a war of choice. I think Israel needs to think strategically where it's really trying to go. We need to help them think that through. But because they say we won't return to a status quo ante doesn't mean that we then have to supply alternative scenarios until they're happy. I mean, their responsibility is to define where is this going. And to my mind, I haven't seen that happening, and I haven't seen it fall into a general strategic framework that represents a secure future for Israel. My sense from conversations with people is that this administration puts a lot of stock in the idea of moral clarity. I think moral superiority helps you an awful lot in the afterlife, but it doesn't do a lot on the battlefield. They believe that Hezbollah is full of bad people. I agree. But that mere moral superiority doesn't defeat Hezbollah. And it seems to me that we need to define some other aim, some other way of getting it. The only aim I see that makes sense, that really deals with Hezbollah, is fundamentally a political solution. That there's not a military solution to the problem of Hezbollah. You can treat it, but you can't cure it. The only way to cure it is to have Lebanese politics step in, constrain Hezbollah, lead Hezbollah to becoming more of a political party, which in part it is as genuinely representing the interests of Shia in Lebanon, in providing for Shia in Lebanon, providing for a population that has felt not only downtrodden but dispossessed for decades and decades and decades. If we don't have a Lebanese political solution to this, there's no solution to this problem in terms of Israeli security. What's happening, it seems to me, over time, is that Lebanon is uniting as a country. They're not turning to push out Hezbollah. That was one of the initial aims, that people would unite against Hezbollah. I don't see that happening. I don't see the Lebanese government strengthening. I don't see the Lebanese government having things to show for its efforts that strengthen it vis-a-vis Hezbollah. I mean, those are the really important things. I mean, Fouad Senyora needed to come out of Rome with something in his pocket that he could deliver as a leader of Lebanon. And he didn't. And that's a tragedy.
Let me just add a couple of points here. One, I think one avenue that we'll probably see explored more, and then there were already hints of this in the papers in the last few days, is whether or not the road to disengagement here runs through Damascus. You know, especially if they find that putting together an international force is very difficult. Highly problematic, as many people have pointed out, because we haven't been talking to Damascus. And my guess is that although Assad will want to show how essential he is to the politics in the region, getting from here to there will be quite difficult and also problematic since under 1559 we engineered the departure of Assad from Lebanese politics, or at least the appearance thereof. You know, there are some problems that don't have solutions, and Hezbollah may actually be one of those, insofar as until there's a radical shift in the picture of Lebanese politics and the picture of the Middle East in general, I don't see Hezbollah being disarmed except by force, and that's going to be hugely problematic. You know, everyone has been talking, as John has, of their evolution into a political party, and they are, but they've managed to become a political party, remain a social welfare organization, and remain a terrorist organization. They're not shrinking their capabilities. They're establishing new ones. And I think this is going to be highly problematic for a long time. And I think, frankly, if you want at the end, I agree with John's assessment of the moral outlook of the administration, but I think if you want to take it a bit farther, you would also say that the administration sees it that way too and doesn't see any way of dispatching Hezbollah short of military action.
Isn't it trying to do that using Israel as a proxy right now? Isn't that the justification for the bomb?
Well, proxy suggests that maybe there's a limited interest on the Israeli part. Obviously, the Israelis have a big interest on their own. Whether it's an alliance or whatever you want to call the relationship, I think that's where the preponderance of common ground is right now. That this is the way to deal with Hezbollah. And I think the question that this all raises is: can enough damage be done to Hezbollah to actually alter the political and the military balance in the region? And that is a big question mark. Everyone's got an opinion on air warfare, on Israel having boots on the ground in Lebanon. I just think there's a big question mark there. The Israelis certainly were quite confident at the beginning of this that they could do it. I don't know exactly what they would say right now.
But just to pick up on that, the important issue of weakening Hezbollah can only be weakened in reference to other players and parties in Lebanese politics. You can weaken Hezbollah in absolute terms and not do anything. Because what matters is Hezbollah in relation to other players in Lebanese politics. And as I've looked at Lebanese politics over the last 2 weeks, I haven't seen Hezbollah be weakened with relation to those other players. I've seen unification in Lebanese politics. I've seen food drives. I've seen blood drives. I've seen relief efforts. I've seen anger. I've seen Lebanese coming together around Hezbollah, not because they love Hezbollah, but because they feel they're being attacked as Lebanese, that their sovereignty is impugned. The way out of this has to be that the prime minister or some Lebanese political figure is able to solve this, and solving it is going to be dragging the United States to be more active than the U.S. has been so far. And in the best chance to do that, that didn't happen today.
Mark Daniel, I'm wondering if it's the same question that through the eyes of the Bush administration, what the stakes are for Bush and the administration, the state's primary goal is to root out terrorism, to engage in terrorism, I'm wondering whether you think that this upheaval, partly addressing the question you said the people are being able to, how much of this upheaval last couple of weeks can help to advance that, or whether or not the feeling and nickname in the last couple of weeks can make that much more difficult for the complex to consider.
Well, there are optics and there are realities, right? Hezbollah and, by extension, Iran is one set of problems. Al-Qaeda is another problem, and Salafi jihadists is another problem, and Iraq is another problem still. And while this, while the the so-called green light in Lebanon will help the president, I think, with his base in terms of seeming uncompromising in the face of terror, I don't think this advances the, that strange phrase, the global war on terror itself, necessarily, except insofar as Hezbollah is degraded as a terrorist force. In other words, I don't see this moving us greatly downfield in terms of the war on terror. I actually also thought Bernard Heichel's piece in today's Times was quite interesting, that this is, will probably get a lot of Sunni jihadists very spun up. So there's just a lot of holes in the dike right now, and each one of them is threatening in its own way.
Let me just add, I think my experience is when I've spoken to radicals in the Middle East, which I must say I did at a safer time, I'm amazed at how little they understand about American psychology. And I'm also amazed at how little we understand about their psychology. And ultimately, a lot of this is psychological, right? I mean, we're trying to understand their thought patterns, and they're trying to understand ours. And just as the United States people did not rise up against the government after September 11th for pursuing unjust policies in the Middle East, which some people said they thought would happen, I don't see what we're doing defeating terror. I see what we're doing creating a sense that the U.S. is utterly indifferent to both the issues of justice and human suffering. And when you come to issues of leadership, moral or otherwise, it seems to me that we're not moving forward. I mean, I think implicit in your question is a judgment that Hezbollah actually is serious about the justification that Israel still occupies Lebanese land because Israel is in Shabbat Farms. Certainly not what the international community thinks. It seems to me it's an excuse, not a justification. I'm sure Hezbollah would find another excuse, because Hezbollah, as an institution, needs to be at war with Israel under its current form. That's not to say that there's not a deal to be struck with Hezbollah, but the idea that giving Shabbat Farms to Hezbollah solves Hezbollah's hostility to Israel is, I think, fantasy. Instead, it sends a message that, see, our resistance won back land again. Shouldn't we keep resisting? Shouldn't everybody resist? I think... You can go down the international mediation route, which I think is where the Rome discussion sort of were suggesting, I'm persuaded that international arbitration means Hezbollah gets shut down just as they got shut down when the UN drew the line. I mean, this is, I just thought, it would be lovely if that would really solve the problem, except it doesn't. To answer your question, you have to tell me when it's going to happen and whether there's a precipitating incident and what that incident is. I mean, I mean, the fact is that it strikes me that those are the key issues you have to resolve. Is when are we 3 weeks into this? Is it next week when she comes back from Southeast Asia? I think increasingly unlikely. When does this happen? And is there a catastrophic event, a huge loss of civilian life? All those things are going to shape how the U.S. intervenes. I think at this point, the administration is very sympathetic with Israeli goals. And is very reluctant to second-guess the Israelis on what they define their needs to do. That's not a blank check, but it's a check. I can imagine any number of scenarios, but that's just speculative. Before today in Rome, I had, there are stories leaking out that the part of the Rice message to Omer was you got to have another week. What I saw in Rome, to my mind, calls that scenario in doubt, because it doesn't create forward movement that you can then build on so that you can wrap it down in a week. Instead, it leaves everything open-ended. It leaves us drifting farther and farther away from the rest of the world and closer to Israel. And at some point, you have to turn the rudder. And I thought that would happen today. I was wrong, it seems. And I'm not sure when we're planning on turning that rudder.
John is right in that one scenario under which this would happen is a replay of Cana or something like that, which would be
of the
bombing of the when the Israelis accidentally shelled a UN post that had where a lot of refugees had. Taken shelter. I think that there is another one. I don't think sometimes you shouldn't mistake ineptitude for intentionality, and Rome may have just blown up because they hadn't teed it up well. That happens, especially with what might be called short course diplomacy, and especially in a situation like this. So it could still be that, the administration believes that it's going to wind this down in 1 or 2 weeks. We just don't know. And there have been, I think things like meeting with the Saudis suggests that this is an administration that doesn't want to show that it's oblivious to opinion in the Arab world. So, you know, I think we're a little bit in the dark as to where it's all going to play out. I would like to just add one or two things, since I'm on record elsewhere and did not entirely agree with Zbigniew, so I want to just say, I think that one of the things you have to understand that's in the administration's mind is that Iran does play a much bigger role in all of this than Dr. Brzezinski believes. And I'm speaking from the perspective of someone who looked at Hezbollah in the counterterrorism framework for some years. I think it's that they believe that it is quite unlikely that this happened independent of Iranian direction. I think that our Iran policy is in tatters, and that they felt that they too had to draw a line in much the way that the Israelis did over Hezbollah provocation. This is where they're drawing the line over Iranian provocation. And so I do think that that's a very big part of it that shouldn't be left out of the picture.
Dan, can I ask you I'd like to ask a question. Rich Armitage.
No, Andrew, that's allowed.
Get in line, buddy.
I thought I was running this, but well, probably not. Hezbollah has been called the A-team of terror. Are they indeed the A-team of terror?
Well, why don't we just say that they're the A-team in the American League as opposed to the A-team in the National League? They're the A-team on the Shia side. You know, Senator Graham, for example, used to say that they were a bigger threat than Al-Qaeda. We're talking, actually, it's even unfair to put them in two leagues in the same sport because they're doing two very different things. Hezbollah is undoubtedly the premier state-sponsored terrorist group in the world today. They have extraordinary technical capabilities. They truly have global reach, but they do not pursue catastrophic terror. Al-Qaeda, which is somewhat degraded from what it was on 9/11, but has been compensated for by the rise of self-starters, still pursues catastrophic terror and does not have lots of diplomatic facilities around the world to draw on for support. So they're very different, but they are very, very capable. And no one should underestimate the threat they pose. And in particular, the Israelis are going to be facing a heightened threat abroad from Hezbollah. Depending on how things unfold in the next few weeks, the United States could too. My own feeling is that absent a U.S. strike on Iranian nuclear facilities, Hezbollah will not be given a green light to attack the United States. It's not like all of us have very good prediction records these days. So,
what in your estimation is the likelihood of a mega attack in Israel, like some of those that have been foiled in recent years?
I think that a suicide attack is always possible. If you mean by a mega attack, you know, the kind of conspiracy that was underway years ago to bring down the largest building in the country, the Israeli Tower, I think that's unlikely. But, one of the interesting things is how relatively quiet the West Bank has been in this period, but that's also a reflection of what's going on with Hamas, Gaza. It's, you know, this is a very complicated situation right now, and my guess is that Hamas is angry enough that its thunder has been stolen and is not prepared to make the picture even messier, at least for a little while. Do you want to opine on that?
I mean, just the fact that you know, one way to see what's going on is Hezbollah saw the Hamas kidnapping of a soldier, a tactic that Hezbollah had pioneered, and said, we'll show you how it's done. We'll see your soldier and raise you a soldier. I mean, honestly, I think that there's a sense that the Hamas people have that this has taken everybody's eyes off Hamas, everybody's eyes off Palestine, that they've been supplanted, which is not what they're trying to do.
Yeah. And I wouldn't rule out the possibility, although it'd be more remote, that the Iranians gave the green light to Hamas to do the original kidnapping, since the relationship is getting closer and closer.
Question.
Well, my sense is that where the U.S. was hoping to go and where Israel was hoping to go would be that they would get agreement in principle for an international force, and therefore Israel would not be permanently occupying Lebanon. They would be occupying Lebanon until the international force came, and therefore they'd have an exit strategy, which is very important given Israel's previous experience in South Lebanon. I don't think that ball got moved forward very much. So it seems to me that was one of the important things the Israelis were hoping to get, was some sense that Rome would present them with an exit strategy from Lebanon. I think this remains, as I said, I think this is going to be a growing problem in Israel if you don't have a broad strategic framework for what you're trying to do. Then how do you define that you've accomplished your war aims? That's big think stuff, and they're trying to do it while they're fighting a war. What political diplomatic? In terms of a goal? I mean, you had all the players there, and you couldn't get them to agree, so you can have more meetings, but I'm not. I think it causes everybody to go back to the drawing board, not to resume in New York with increased vigor. As I said, I mean, if you have all the players there, and you can't make it work there in a special meeting, I don't know why that gives you forward momentum to have more meaning.
We have time for just a couple more, Omar.
I personally believe that there was much more planning and coordination between the Iranians, the Syrians, Hamas, and Hezbollah. But today I read the statement, and they think they were going to divert pressure and attention from the Iranians and the Syrians and the problems that they were having, the international community and the United States anyhow. But they misjudged the degree of Israeli reaction. They never thought that it would be on such a large scale. And today, actually, what was very interesting for me is to read a statement by one of the leaders of Hamas saying that we never imagined that the Israelis would react the way they did in such a comprehensive manner. We thought that they would hit some of our bases, kidnap some of our leaders, and then we would have negotiations.
This is Nasrallah, yeah?
Today.
Nasrallah said it yesterday. Yeah.
No, not Nasrallah. Mahmoud something. Today.
Oh, Mahmoud something.
Yeah. I don't remember the...
We've eliminated half of them.
Yeah. I don't remember the surname now. But the statement is today's mass media, anyhow, international. And he's one of the leaders of Hamas. And this is exactly what he said. I don't know what you think of that.
On the Hezbollah front, Hezbollah had kidnapped or attempted to kidnap a large number of Israeli soldiers in the past. Somebody had read something in recent days, 11 attempts to kidnap Israeli soldiers. And had never gotten this reaction. I think part of it is that you have a new prime minister without a long security resume, a defense minister without a long security resume, new government, they have to show their toughness. One way to look at it is that the army had been champing at the bit to go after Hezbollah, and Sharon kept saying, no, we're not going to fight that war. And when you have a new leadership without a lot of defense credibility, and the army says, we're going, they didn't have the strength as civilian leadership to stand up against the army. That's one set of explanations I've heard Israelis make. I think it does have something to do with the fact that this is a new Israeli government, and it seems which wanted to prove its toughness, felt the need to prove its toughness, and a basic miscalculation by both Hamas and Hezbollah as to where it would go. The other part of this is that I think Hamas was feeling increasingly backed into a corner. That clear Israeli policy, in many ways U.S. policy, has continued to constrict and constrain Hamas and try to promote the collapse of the Hamas government. And I think that shaped where they thought their long-term endgame could go. Hezbollah had no similar urgency. I mean, that was opportunism on Hezbollah's part. I don't see any signs that it was predictable what the Israelis would do. And as I say, a war of choice on the Israelis' part.
I would just add to that that the I do think that everyone was surprised by the Israeli reaction, although from an Israeli perspective, it makes a lot of sense. Given the political program that the government, as Sean pointed out, given the sense that two unilateral withdrawals had yielded no benefits, and that and the growing feeling that it's a mistake to leave anywhere without a quid pro quo. One shouldn't forget the domestic Lebanese perspective, and that is that Hezbollah probably thought that it needed to reestablish its bona fides as a resistance organization in the face of a growing sense that Hezbollah was a problem in domestic politics because it wouldn't disarm. I think there was a pushback there. So I do think that there was an overdetermination of reasons why this would be a valuable thing to do from Hezbollah's perspective.
Now, Hezbollah was talking about how it was going to be a priority to free their prisoners. Mm-hmm. When Hezbollah frees prisoners, it takes Israeli hostage and trades. I mean, they were talking quite openly about it.
Yeah, they called this the year of the year of freeing the prisoners. Yeah.
Thank you all so much for coming. And thanks to John and Dan and Dr. Brzezinski for such a terrific briefing. Thanks again.